our elevated back porch, as if we are on the deck of a ship sailing through a green sea of woods and grass. We revel in the many birds around us, huge woodpeckers with red caps, tiny house wrens building nests in our flower pots, colourful hummingbirds feeding on our red impatience. We feel exceedingly content with life. Everything seems to be going right. But very soon, I will begin to wonder whether the rats from my early experiments are exacting their revenge on me. Because the same brain structure that I sabotaged in thousands of rodents will begin to malfunction spectacularly in my own brain. The cause will not be a neurotoxin injected into my hippocampus that damages my frontal cortex. It will be something far more prosaic and far more familiar. Cancer. 2. The Vanishing Hand. At the beginning of January 2015, roughly 2.5 years after handling my first human brain, I decide to fulfill a dream I've held for years, to compete in an Ironman triathlon. Though I've completed several Olympic distance triathlons, I've never tried anything as challenging as an Ironman, which is 140.6 miles of combined swimming, running, and cycling. But it's now or never. My last reasonable chance before I'm too old. I plan to train with a coach and complete this summer or fall in a half Ironman, with 3 stages that cover a combined distance of 70.3 miles. If that goes well, I will attempt a full Ironman the following year, when I'm at the ripe old age of 65. It's going to demand incredible effort, but I feel ready and the time feels right. Mirek and our 2 children, who followed me from Poland some 26 years ago, have long since settled into our new home, making wonderful lives for themselves in America, just as I have. They, too, are successful and happy. Mirek is a computer engineer in a large software company. Kasia is an endocrinologist at the Yale School of Medicine, where she focuses on diabetes. And Vitek is a neuroscientist in the Brain Modulation Lab at the University of Pittsburgh. Both of my children are in happy relationships, and Kasia and her husband Jake have 2 young sons, our beloved grandsons, Lucien and Sebastian, who are growing up rapidly. Mirek and I are celebrating 30 years of a good marriage. With my family happy and my career going so well, I can devote more time to my hobbies. Especially sports. I'm obsessed with developing lean, powerful muscles, not only to feel healthy and strong, but because I like looking healthy and strong too. I'm in excellent shape and eager to become even more athletic as I prepare for my greatest physical challenge yet. In the first days of the new year, I hire a coach and start preparations for the half Ironman. I buy my dream bike, a white carbon fiber Cannondale Evo road bike with high-end components, 11-speed Altegra and deep carbon wheels. Since swimming is my slowest event, I decide to concentrate over the winter on my swimming technique. Several times a week, I get up before dawn and go to a nearby pool to swim 80 to 100 laps, about 2 to 3,000 yards, before heading to work. On a Thursday morning toward the end of January, as I pull myself in the pool after one of my first training sessions, I suddenly feel dizzy. I must have overtrained or run out of calories, I tell myself. I'm looking forward to a productive and upbeat day. Tomorrow morning I'm leaving for a conference on brain research in Montana, where I'm meeting Vitek and his girlfriend, Cheyenne, for work and skiing, and I'm excited about the trip. But as I drive to work, I have a strange feeling that something's off. My driving feels shaky, although I can't tell what's wrong. At my office, I sit down and begin to eat a bowl of steel-cut oatmeal I brought from home. I reach out to switch on my computer. My stomach clenches. My right hand is gone. I can't see it. It's disappeared. I move my hand toward the left. There it is. It's back. but when I slide it back to the lower right quadrant of the computer keyboard, it vanishes again. I repeat my movements and the same thing happens. Whenever I place my hand in the lower right quadrant of my field of vision, it disappears completely, as if it were cut off at the wrist. Nearly paralyzed with fear, I try again and again to recapture my disappearing right hand. But once it enters that part of my visual field, it's gone. It's like a freaky magic trick, mesmerizing, frightening, and totally inexplicable. Except brain tumor. I immediately try to push the thought from my mind. No, I think, that can't be it. This cannot be happening. I was sure that I beat stage 3 breast cancer in 2009 and stage 1B melanoma 3 years ago. But breast cancer and melanoma often metastasize to the brain. I know that a brain tumor in the occipital lobe, the area at the back of the brain that controls vision, is the most likely explanation for this bizarre vision loss. And I know that any brain tumor indicating metastasis, the spread of cancer cells, is horrifying news. A brain tumor would be too cruel and too deadly, so it must be something else. Perhaps the side effect of an antibiotic I'm taking for an infection. I quickly Google doxycycline, and sure enough, vision problems and hallucinations are a side effect. Very rare, but documented nonetheless. Clearly, I tell myself, that's the problem. Greatly relieved, I head to the conference room, where I'm meeting with a small group of visiting scientists. Once everyone has arrived, we begin to discuss our findings on how genes operate in the prefrontal cortex of patients with schizophrenia. But I can't focus on the presentation. Whenever I look at the projection screen or at my colleagues' faces, parts are absent, like a surrealist painting or a puzzle with a missing piece. Although the missing section is less than a quarter of my field of vision on just one side, the void still terrifies me. It feels like there's a hole in my mind. With a terrible gravity, it pulls me back toward the one explanation I don't want to consider. Brain tumor. I desperately try to pretend I'm participating in the meeting, but the idea has become stuck in my head. Brain tumor, brain tumor, brain tumor. After an hour of torture, I abruptly leave the conference room and run back to my office. I sit at my desk for a while, leaning my forehead against its cool surface as I try to process this bizarre situation. But although I turn it over and over, inspecting it from every possible angle, this symptom has only a single likely explanation, the one that frightens me most. I have to get out of here. I have to go home. I run to the parking garage, find my car, and drive fast to Annandale, my heart racing the entire way. At home, my skis and helmet are ready and my suitcases are packed. I throw a last glance at my notes and piles of conference materials, making sure I have everything I need. Early tomorrow, I fly to Big Sky, Montana, to the annual winter conference on brain research. As the elected president of the conference this year, I've been key in organizing the meeting, which will draw 500 neuroscientists from all over the world. I'm also giving the welcoming address to the group, and I've carefully prepared my speech. I've attended this meeting every year for the past 24 years. With its balance of work and outdoor fun, it's my favorite conference. Early each morning, we attend sessions on topics related to brain function, mental illness, and drug addiction. We break for several hours to hit the ski slopes, chatting with our colleagues about our research as we ride the chairlifts up the mountain. Mid-afternoon, we reconvene for professional sessions and often work together late into the night. I'm particularly excited this year because my son, Vitek, will be at the conference. He and I will work together, then go skiing with Cheyenne. The forecast is excellent. Snow for the next 5 days, and I can't wait to hit the trails. I can almost smell the frosty air and feel the bite of freezing wind on my face as I speed down the slopes, zigzagging through the trees and kicking up blinding clouds of snow. I love skiing even more than science. It gives me the feeling of weightlessness, an extraordinary lightness of being, a sense of freedom as I fly in and out of control. It's challenging and risky, navigating the tight trees on a fast run or jumping off the rocks into the white nothingness requires instantaneous decision-making and trust in one's agile body, sharp vision and strong muscles. And the beauty of the surroundings. Skyscraping mountains over and around me, glittering snow under my feet. The sweet, sweet feeling of paradise. But this problem with my eyesight weighs heavily on me. I still can't see anything that wanders into the lower right quadrant of my field of vision. I try to squelch the panic that is growing inside of me. I just can't accept that this weird phenomenon is serious enough to keep me from Montana. It simply must not be the one thing I've suspected from the moment my hand disappeared this morning, the absolute worst possibility. I won't even let the word tumor emerge from my mouth. But on some barely conscious level, I know my situation may be dangerous. I have to act, and quickly. I call our family doctor, Eugene Schmoren, and ask for a last-minute appointment. It's late afternoon and near the end of his office hours, but he agrees to see me immediately. I don't tell Mirek or anyone else where I'm going, not wanting to alarm them, and not wanting to admit the terrible possibility even to myself. Dr. Schmoren has been our family doctor for almost 26 years, since we first moved here from Poland. When we became his patients, he was young, tall and handsome, just starting his private practice. Over the decades, we've all aged together, witnessing one another's skin sag a little and bodies grow rounder. We've joked about our worsening hearing and eyesight. Like us, Dr. Schmoren likes to run and cycle, and we often discuss with him the results of our latest races. We feel a close connection with him. Over the years, Dr. Schmoren has saved our family from a variety of mini-disasters, like my herniated disc and the clot in my husband's subclavian vein that led to the removal of two of his ribs. He was with us when I had my first bout with cancer, a battle that cost me my left breast. Then, in late 2011, he found a melanoma on the skin behind my ear that my dermatologist had missed. My first husband died of melanoma, so I was terrified by the diagnosis. But Dr. Schmoren saw us through that storm too. Since then, I've allowed myself to become optimistic about my health, and my family has followed my lead. Until today, I was sure that the worst was over. After a painful operation and radiation treatment that beat the melanoma into remission, I was warned by the oncologists that there was a 30% chance it would return. But I shrugged off their words. No way, I thought. It's never coming back. But as I sit before Dr. Schmoren and describe my vision problem, my confidence wavers. It is the eye. It must be the eye, I tell him. The problem can't be with my brain. As he examines me, I start to speak faster. I'm taking doxycycline, which can cause this side effect, I blurt. I googled it. Hurry up, I think. I have no time to waste. I'm leaving tomorrow morning for my wonderful trip. Let's get this over with, and fast. Dr. Schmoren continues to check my vision, my eyes, my neurological responses. I notice his serious expression, his unsmiling face. His usual composure is cracking. Why worry? I reassure him. Things like this can happen. I don't think it's your eye, he says. I freeze. I know that it's not the eye. It's the brain. You can't see anything on your lower right quadrant with both eyes open, nor can you see that area with either your left or right eye alone. he says. But your eyes see perfectly well anywhere else. This suggests that your eyes and optic nerves are probably fine, but the brain regions that process visual information from your lower right field are experiencing some trouble. I want you to see an ophthalmologist immediately. He leaves the room to call her. I am terrified. We need our brains, as well as our eyes, in order to see. The eyes pick up visual information in the world, and the optic nerves send it to the occipital lobe, or visual cortex, the part of the brain where it is processed. If there's a problem in your left eye, you won't be able to see on the left. But if there's a problem in an area of the visual cortex in your brain, neither eye will be able to see a particular visual field, which is the very problem I'm having. I call Mirek and Kasia and tell them I'm at Dr. Shmorum's office because I can't see things in the lower right side of my visual field. Kasia is clearly concerned, but I insist it's not a big deal. I say I'll call again after I talk to the ophthalmologist. The ophthalmologist, Dr. Julie F. Lee, is right across the street. She checks my vision, dilates my pupils, shines a strong bluish light deep into my eyes. Her pretty young face is close to mine across the slit lamp, her glittering earrings almost touching my ears and cheeks. I like how she smells, a delicate fragrance of perfume. She finds nothing wrong with my optic nerves or retinas, no cataracts. But when she leans back, her smile has disappeared and her eyes are sad. I'm afraid it's in your brain, she says. It must be something in your occipital cortex. We need to do more tests. I run back across the street. Dr. Shmorum's office is now closed, but he's waiting for me in the darkened reception area, along with Mirek, who's just arrived. Mirek's quiet presence always calms me. Though he was stricken with polio at 18 months of age and still walks with a significant limp, the polio vaccine wasn't available in Poland until the late 1950s, a few years after it came out in the United States. He is an excellent cyclist, with strong muscles in his arms and in his dominant leg. He's an intellectual, unfailingly kind and warm, with a wry but gentle sense of humour. I have a strong personality, loud and laughing and stubborn about my opinions. But Mirek loves me just as I am, and is always supportive of whatever I want to do. I look to him for comfort now, even as I stand defiantly apart from him and Dr. Shmorum in the dark waiting area. My brave exterior is beginning to crumble. We have to do an MRI of your brain as soon as possible, Dr. Shmorum says. But I'm leaving tomorrow morning. I have plane tickets, I respond. I'm the conference president. I have to go. Words pour out in a terrified stream. I have to go. I have to ski. There will be no conference without me. I'm essential. I repeat the same points over and over, like a child desperately trying to convince her parents to let her stay up past her bedtime. Dr. Shmorum is usually subdued, but today he is very firm. I can't let you go anywhere before we figure this out, he says. It could be dangerous to travel. We need to do an MRI immediately. You need to find any place that can take you tomorrow morning. Mirek sides with him. I continue to argue for an hour. I'm not one to give up easily on what I want, but they won't budge, and I finally give in. Okay, I tell myself, I will do the MRI and delay my trip by one day, just to make them happy. Mirek and I head home in separate cars. I follow him closely because my vision loss makes it very difficult to drive. It's dark and I have a hard time navigating the winding, wintry roads. Try as I might, I can't stay in the middle of the lane. When we get home, I call the airline and postpone my flight by a day. I also call Vitek to say he should still go to the Big Sky, but I'll be late joining him. Tomorrow, January the 23rd, is his birthday, and I feel terrible I won't be there. I call a few friends who are headed to the conference. "You won't believe what's happened," I say in a cheery voice. "I cannot see well and have to have it checked out before I join you. I'll just be delayed by one day." I try not to let my fear enter my voice. Early the next morning, we go to a nearby imaging center for the MRI. I insist that I do the driving because I always drive, and I want us both to feel that everything is normal. But I drive very poorly, weaving across the lanes. "I'm fine," I snap, nerves frayed, when Mirek asks to take the wheel. "Leave me alone." Somehow, we arrive at the MRI center without getting into an accident. The front desk person checks me in. Only then does it really hit me that I am being scanned for a possible tumor in my brain. I am nauseated with fear as I prepare for the MRI, which is going to create a very detailed image of my brain and perhaps reveal some horrifying things. A nurse inserts an intravenous line in my arm, which delivers into my bloodstream a contrast liquid that is absorbed by brain tissue. The MRI will use a computerized system to produce pictures or scans of my brain that doctors will examine for tumors, strokes, nerve damage, and other abnormalities that X-rays, CT scans, and ultrasound machines cannot reliably detect. A technician slides me into the tight tube of the MRI machine and turns on the noisy magnet. I lie motionless for an hour before the scan is complete and I am finally free. When we head home to wait for the results, Mirek drives. I am completely exhausted, drained by fear and the stress of the scanning procedure on what it might reveal. We are home by mid-morning. My flight leaves this afternoon. I pack and repack, adding this and that, an extra pair of warm gloves and socks, the sunscreen that I almost forgot. I'm hoping the doctor will call soon with the only possible news that it's not a tumor. But the impossible happens. At around 11 a.m., the phone rings. I pick it up and sit down on a stool as Mirek runs to join me in the kitchen. "I'm so sorry," Dr. Shmorum says. "I don't know how to even tell you this." His voice breaks. He pauses. "The scan found 3 tumors in your brain," he finally continues. "You have to go to the ER right away. 1 tumor is bleeding, which strongly suggests it might be melanoma. Melanoma tumors have a tendency to bleed. It can be very dangerous." Watching my face, Mirek knows our world has taken a tragic turn. I think about the weather. It is a bright, sunny day here in the Washington suburbs. Snowstorms are in the forecast for later today and tomorrow, and it's going to snow in Montana. I try to stand up from the kitchen stool, but can't move. I'm going to die. For a fleeting moment, that thought floods through me, but I kick it away with all my might and spring into action. My response to emergencies of any sort is to throw myself into a rational, organized plan and grasp whatever control I can. I hang up with Dr. Shmorum and immediately telephone my son. "Bitek, I cannot go to Big Sky. I have tumors in my brain," I say. "I'm so sorry. It is your birthday and I'm not going to make it." He is, of course, shocked, and I feel like a bad mother for putting my family through so much pain again. I telephone Kasia in New Haven and my sister Maria in Boston. Both are stunned. I call my colleagues at the conference and suggest they ask a past president to substitute for me and deliver my speech, which I will email to them. They, too, are dumbstruck. For my sake and for my family's, I am determined to get the best care possible, and I begin to research my options. Staying focused on a plan of attack keeps me from obsessing over the tumors that, at this moment, are flourishing in my brain. I call Dr. Claudine Isaacs, my breast cancer oncologist at Georgetown University Hospital. "A horrible thing has happened. I have tumors in my brain," I say. Maybe it is breast cancer metastases, but one tumor is bleeding, so my family doctor thinks it's melanoma. Where should I go? When she speaks, it is clear she is shaken. She tells me to go immediately to the ER at Georgetown and directs me to see Dr. Michael B. Atkins, a melanoma oncologist who she says is phenomenal. She says she will meet me there. From the corner of the hallway, poised for my trip, my skis stare at me. Sleek, beautiful Rosignols that I bought last year. They respond to the slightest movement of my feet, my toes, even my mind, it seems. With them I fly through the snow, fluid and graceful. Now I'm headed to the hospital, and they will have to stay behind. It's Friday afternoon before a snowstorm, not a good time to enter an emergency room. My blood pressure is sky high, perhaps from anxiety, perhaps from a bleeding brain tumor. The nurses give me steroids to prevent brain swelling caused by tissue irritation from the bleeding tumor. I lie for hours on a cot behind a flimsy curtain. All around, Mirek and me echo the sounds of rushing, crying, screaming, the sounds of distress and endangered human lives. It's devastating to be back in this world just 3 years after undergoing surgery for skin cancer. Doctors come and go, all asking the same questions, and I tell them the same thing. I cannot see on the right lower side. My MRI shows brain tumors and one is bleeding. I've had breast cancer and melanoma. It turns out that Dr. Atkins is away today, but Dr. Isaacs comes in and offers words of support. She leaves. More doctors cycle through the room. A neurosurgeon swings through and advises against brain surgery in favor of radiation, which will be safer than cutting into my brain. A radiation oncologist visits and gives the same recommendation. No decisions are made. We wait for hours. Maria calls again and again from Boston, where she is a physicist and chief of therapy in the radiation oncology department at Brigham and Women's Hospital. Come to the Brigham, she insists. The doctors here are the best. I talked to Dr. Iser, a radiation oncologist. He says that surgery should be done first and then radiation. How can I possibly go? I'm lying here in the ER with a bleeding tumor in my head. Despite all my years of studying the brain, I'm not a neurologist or any other kind of medical doctor. I know close to nothing about what could happen to me. Will the tumor burst open and flood my brain with blood? Wouldn't that kill me? I better not move. But Maria wants me to see the doctors she knows and trusts. What should I do? Shortly after 8 p.m, the flimsy curtains part, and Vitek and Cheyenne appear. They cancelled their trip to Montana and drove down from Pittsburgh. Oh, what a joy it is to see them. Despite my fear and despair, I'm ecstatic that they're here. Soon after, Kasia arrives. She took the Acela train from New Haven and made it just before the storm. Mirek and I are so happy to have everyone together, to breathe the smell of their bodies and touch their faces, kiss their cheeks. Kasia is very tired. A few hours earlier, she herself was seeing patients. She lies down with me on the cot, and we snuggle closely like we did when she was my little baby. Vitek and Cheyenne fetch sushi from the hospital cafeteria, and we share a feast on my bed amid the IV lines and crumpled sheets. We're surrounded by the frightening sounds of the ER, but we're together in this ordeal, my family and I. At midnight, they leave. I remain in the ER, listening to beeping and more beeping, to the tragic noises of people in desperate need of help. Nurses peek in from time to time, and I plead with them to transfer me to a quieter place. At 3 in the morning, they move me to a room in the ER that I share with an older woman who is in serious pain and surrounded by a large family. In the morning, Mirek and my children return, and our waiting resumes. It's Saturday, and the hospital is overcrowded. No doctors stop in to see me. Nothing is happening. By noon, we've made our decision. We are leaving here and going to the Brigham in Boston tomorrow. But it isn't as easy as we thought. The attending physician refuses to approve it, and the nurse tells us that insurance will not pay for the ER visit if I check out against medical advice. I'm afraid to leave without their approval, I tell Kasia. What if the tumor bleeds even more, and this hospital visit will cost us tons of money if insurance doesn't pay? But Kasia is checking on her iPhone for the patient's bill of rights and the insurance rules, which contradict the nurse. It's not true, Kasia says. We are leaving, Mom. We head north to Boston early the next day, Sunday, January the 25th. Before we leave, my friend, Jania, a hairdresser, comes to my room to cut my hair. I called her at dawn and told her my news, and she rushed over, arriving in her pajamas at 7 a.m. I ask her to give me a crew cut in case they open my skull. It will be easier for the wound to heal, I explain. Merrick and I pack our Toyota RAV4 with our trainers and road bikes, so we can use them as stationary bikes in my sister's basement. We agree that no matter what happens, our athletic training can't stop. I also take my skis, just in case. Mirek, Kasia and I hit the wintry roads, snow falling lightly, as Vitek and Cheyenne follow in their car. We pass a nearby construction site where a giant supermarket is being built. I've been so excited in recent months that we will finally have a decent grocery store in the neighborhood and will no longer have to drive for miles in traffic just to do our shopping. Will I live to see it open? I wonder. I feel the urge to talk, to plan the future for my family. I'm sure I'm going to die. Not right away, but soon, maybe in a few days or weeks. I have, of course, researched my condition on the internet. The prognosis for metastatic melanoma in the brain is terrible, especially if you're over 60 and you have 3 or more tumors. I have 3 tumors and I'm 63 years old. 4 to 7 months of life is all I've got left. I will be dead as early as May, as late as August. I won't make it to 64. As I sit next to Mirek, who is driving, I can't stop thinking about my family's future. I need to write my will and create a trust for my assets to make things easier for them. I want my belongings to be fairly divided with no arguments, no lawyers, no complications. Mirek will have to sell the house, I say to Kasia, who is sitting in the back seat. He needs to move closer to you kids or my sister. Stop, Mom, Kasia says. Let's talk about something nice. We'll go cross-country skiing. You'll like it. I stop speaking about my plans because I see my grim preparation is hurting them. But I continue silently. Mirek cannot stay alone. How difficult would it be for him in our house, with everything the same, but without me there anymore? How would I feel if he were gone? How lonely to come back to a darkened house, my clothes still there, my earrings, my life as I had left it, but no me. I feel so sorry for him that my eyes well up with tears. I'm afraid they will see me crying. I have to shake it off and stop thinking such thoughts. But Kasia knows. Mom, it'll be all right, she says tenderly. Mirek will be fine. We'll all be fine. Don't worry. But of course I worry. I worry for them and for myself. We all stop for the night at Kasia and Jake's house in New Haven. Our grandsons, Lucian and Sebastian, greet Mirek and me with shrieks of joy. They don't fully understand what's happening, but they know that Babcia, Polish for grandmother, is sick and everyone is worried. This house is freighted with meaning and memories. When Mirek, Kasia, Vitek and I first moved to America in 1989, we lived in a rental apartment in a subdivision of townhouses in Alexandria, Virginia, among a sea of immigrants from around the world. We were delighted by the size of our apartment. With bedrooms for each child, it was the largest place we'd ever lived and seemed like a mansion. We owned no furniture, so a work colleague loaned me a queen-size air mattress that Merrick and I shared, and the children slept on large pieces of foam we bought at a garage sale for a dollar each. At a church sale, we paid $35 for a chrome-plated table and beaten-up chairs with plastic yellow cushions that felt luxurious after weeks of sitting on the floor and using a cardboard box for our table. It was Kasia who first mentioned that the only kids who got off the school bus at the housing complex were recent immigrants. Other kids, she meant richer kids, lived in single-family homes in nice neighborhoods. We researched what it took to buy a house and found that a mortgage would cost about the same as our rent, and that the money would go into our own property. It was a revelation. The concept of owning a house was thrilling and totally foreign. We began looking for something that we could afford, and in the real estate section of the Washington Post, we found a house in Annandale, Virginia, in a neighborhood very close to the one we were in. With large colonial single-family houses and meticulously kept yards. The property we bought stood out as long neglected, with spots of bare earth and huge tree roots cutting through the front yard. And the house needed a lot of work, but it backed onto woods and a stream. Most important, it was our land, all the way to the center of the earth. We loved the sense of freedom and independence that it offered. It told us that we had made it in America. Both Kasia and Vitek now have beautiful three-story homes of their own. Vitek and Cheyenne live in a bohemian district of Pittsburgh, and Kasia and Jake's home is a sky-blue Victorian on a quiet street a mile from the Yale campus. Every time we visit them, the sight of all they have accomplished makes my heart swell with pride and love. As do Kasia and Jake's adorable children, my grandsons, Lucien and Sebastian. Everything about these boys makes me deliriously happy. The smell of their hair and skin is intoxicating, overpowering. I love their smiling faces, their funny, uneven, oversized teeth, their messed-up, sweaty hair, the energy bubbling in their little bodies. There's nothing I love more than visiting them and playing their games with them, reading to them, walking them to school. I try to cherish every moment of their childhoods, a time in their lives that will, of course, pass too quickly. Where does it come from, this overpowering love of a grandmother for her grandchildren? 40 years ago, when Kasia was born, my mother-in-law laughed and wept and doted on her first grandchild, clapping with joy and excitement at every minute change of expression on the baby's face, every movement of her tiny hands or feet. I was embarrassed for her. Then Kasia's son, Sebastian, was born in 2006, and I, quite similarly, became a doting grandma. When Lucien was born 3 years later, it happened again. I felt the extraordinary emotions triggered by becoming a grandmother. Just as my own Babcia adored me and showered me with unconditional love, I discovered that a grandma's love is boundless, stupefying, sentimental, and capable of turning one's brain into schmaltzy mush. It's also superbly gratifying and blissful, and I have never felt more desperate for these two small, precious boys than I do now. We all take Sebastian and Lucien to school the next morning, a Monday. It hits me that I may never see them again, and a wave of maddening sorrow rises inside my chest, floods my body, and chokes my throat. I kiss their heads, smell their hair, hug their thin little bodies, and leave. Mirek, Kasia, Cheyenne, Vitek, and I continue north, leaving Jake behind to care for the boys. He will join us later. It's snowing again as we pass through the stark, binary landscape. White roads, white fields sliced with black rivers, black tree trunks with branches like pencil strokes on white paper. A frozen world. I feel I am frozen, too, as fragile as a thin sheet of ice. A tap in the wrong spot and I could shatter. We arrive in Boston before noon. Maria has already arranged for appointments today with various doctors at the Brigham and Women's Hospital and the affiliated Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. My melanoma oncologist, Dr. Stephen Hoddy, is at Dana-Farber, while Dr. A.L.A. Iser, a warm, caring and meticulous radiation oncologist, and Dr. Ian Dunn, a neurosurgeon, are on staff at the Brigham. They will all work together on my case. There are six of us at each appointment. Kasia, Vitek, Cheyenne, Mirek, Maria and I, as well as the doctor and a nurse, and sometimes a resident or an assistant too. Sometimes the doctor has to ask which of us is the patient, which amuses us. We crowd the rooms, my tall and handsome family. My sister and I are the smallest. And at each visit, the staff has to add chairs. Each doctor does the same simple test of my vision. He raises the index and middle fingers of one hand in a V shape and moves the V up, down, left and right in each of four visual quadrants, asking whether I can see it. When the V is moved into my lower right quadrant, it's invisible to me. I immediately have another MRI as well as a CT / positron emission tomography, PET or PET scan, which will reveal the location of any fast-dividing cancer cells. We spend a long time with Dr. Iser, who explains why surgery on the bleeding tumour should be done first, followed by radiation of the area and of the two other tumours. He takes care to describe everything clearly and spends hours discussing the scans. My oncologist, Dr. Hoddy, a world-famous expert in cutting-edge treatments for melanoma, says surgery and radiation must be done before he steps in with other therapies. His explanations are convincing, and we all agree with his proposed treatment plan. As we wait to meet the neurosurgeon, Kasia looks at my records and exclaims, "Oh my gosh, your surgeon is Ian Dunn, my friend from medical school." "Is he any good?" I ask. "Fantastic," she assures me, "very studious." My family crowds into the small office, and Kasia is sitting with me on the examining table when Dr. Dunn arrives with his assistant. He and Kasia chat and laugh. "What a coincidence," he says. Dr. Dunn pulls up the scans on his computer and points to the frightening shapes on them. I glance at them quickly, then look away. As much as I have studied brains, I don't like peering into my own when it is damaged like this. I don't like to see scary black spots where healthy grey tissue should be. Just as my ophthalmologist and I suspected, the tumour causing my symptoms is in the primary visual cortex, in the occipital lobe at the back of my head, which is why it's affecting my vision. The size of a large raisin, it's nestled down in the sulcus, the narrow valley between two gyri, like a little black sheep hidden in a crevice between two hills. Although it's bleeding, it's not in the worst place, I tell myself. If it were in my spinal cord, I might be paralyzed. If it were in my brainstem, which controls basic life functions like breathing, then surgery might be too dangerous and out of the question. I'm fortunate that it grew in a place that didn't threaten my life, but let itself be known. Had the tumor developed without noticeable symptoms, if my hand hadn't disappeared and freaked me out, it might have thrived for quite a while before any of us noticed anything wrong. I'm sure I would have died. There's a lot of luck in this unlucky situation. This nasty little raisin is saving my life. For now. Dr. Dunn explains that he will stop the bleeding and remove the tumour. A lab will examine it to determine whether it is, in fact, melanoma, and if so, what kind. "Am I going to go blind?" I ask. Surgery always involves serious risks, including, in my case, damage to the occipital lobe, which could result in the loss of vision. "Probably not, although theoretically it's possible," he says. "And if you don't, you may still have vision problems. It's also possible that you won't wake up after surgery. That's unlikely, but I must inform you of all the risks." His young male nurse, energetic and cheerful, presents a consent form listing all the terrifying things that could go wrong. I sign it, and we leave. The surgery is planned for the next day, Tuesday, January the 27th. But a huge snowstorm is on its way. It will come to be known as the Blizzard of 2015, a nor'easter that will dump tons of snow in the northeastern part of the United States and Canada. As we drive to my sister's house in the Boston suburbs, snow is already falling. The narrow, winding roads are slippery and soon become shrouded in white. The Toyota skids often as we hold our breath. We end up waiting 2 more days for my surgery as the blizzard covers the world around us. The snow piles up to the windows of my sister's house. After the storm, it's beautiful outside, quiet and calm. I walk with Kasia and Vitek in the woods, and the snow reaches up to our thighs. It is light, fluffy. I lie down on my back and make snow angels. We are laughing. It is so good to be alive. Since the surgery is delayed, I spend my time enjoying my family, and I completely block out any thoughts about the tumours. Although I'm an expert in the brain, I'm repelled by what's going on inside my own. When I held that first brain in my palms at the brain bank, I could admire it with detached interest, because it wasn't mine. Now, while I want to participate in my treatment by selecting a highly skilled team of doctors, I don't want to look at my MRIs or think about what's happening in my skull. My own brain presents a mortal danger to me. It is Thursday before the roads are clear enough for us to make it back into Boston. The traffic is heavy that morning, and it takes forever to get to the hospital. The streets are clogged with cars moving very slowly in deep snow, and there's more snow in the forecast. Finally, we arrive. My whole family is with me, including Jake, who's joined us after leaving the boys with his mother in New Haven. In the late morning, we enter a large area with semi-private cubicles furnished with couches and comfortable armchairs. These provide families some privacy as they wait for their loved ones to come out of surgery. My family has brought all kinds of things to entertain themselves with. Books, games, computers. They were told the wait could be long. The blizzard may have contributed to the delay. And 2 or 3 hours pass before I'm even taken to the pre-op area. But we're all in good moods, joking and chattering as if we're at a party, abuzz with nervous energy. When they call for me, I head into pre-op with Mirek and my sister. There, I'm examined by the nurse, meet the anesthesiologist, and visit again with my surgeon, Dr. Dunn. Far from being scared, I feel immense relief that the surgery is finally happening, that I soon will be under anesthesia and won't know or remember anything. A nurse administers a strong sedative as I sit in the pre-op room, and soon I begin to float away. I embrace the darkening of my mind, unaware that this brush with oblivion is only the beginning of my long and dangerous journey. 3. Into my brain. As soon as I am unconscious, Dr. Dunn drills into the back of my skull to reach the bleeding tumour in the occipital lobe. He finds the nasty raisin relatively easily. It's growing between the folds of my primary visual cortex. With the help of his surgical team, Dr. Dunn scoops out the tumour and suctions out the blood. He replaces the portion of my skull that he removed to gain access to my brain, seals the bone with titanium screws, and stitches me up. To keep the sutures intact, he folds the skin of my scalp and rolls it along the 5-inch incision so that it looks like a fat earthworm glued to the back of my head. Later, it will flatten out into a neat scar. A few hours later, I open my eyes. The first thing I notice, I can see. I'm not blind. I can see everywhere, in all my visual fields, left, right, up and down. I gaze around the hospital room, testing my eyesight, raising my fingers in a V-shape and moving them into each of the 4 visual quadrants like my doctors did before the surgery. No problems. None. I can see the V no matter where I place it. No vanishing hand, no blocked fields, nothing abnormal. The tumor and bleeding haven't caused permanent damage to my occipital cortex. I'm so relieved. But for one detail. Dr. Dunn informs us that the tumor appears to be metastatic melanoma. We'll know for sure in a few days after we get the results from the lab. In the meantime, all we can do is stew over the idea that, just as we feared, I'm most likely battling this dreaded type of cancer all over again. Melanoma is the rarest but most dangerous form of skin cancer, diagnosed in about 130,000 people each year, most of them fair-skinned like me. It develops from melanocytes, skin cells that carry a dark skin pigment called melanin, which protects deeper skin layers from the damaging effects of the sun. Many melanomas begin as moles, harmless growths of melanocytes that can turn cancerous over time. Once that happens, melanoma has a propensity to metastasize, often spreading from its original site in the skin to lymph nodes and organs, especially the lungs, liver, and brain. When it spreads there, it's almost invariably terminal. For all we know, I've been handed a death sentence. We have no doubt I'm going to die. My family and doctors and I are certain of it. We don't discuss it aloud, but the terrible reality of it lingers among us. That night, Thursday, January the 29th, my exhausted family heads to my sister's house while I stay in the hospital to recuperate. As I lie in bed, I feel no pain, but I cannot sleep. I'm loaded with steroids to prevent swelling in my brain, and one of the side effects is insomnia. I'm wide awake, my mind exploding with memories. In this dark hour, the intensive care unit nurse, who is monitoring me, pulls up a chair next to my bed and sits down. As the snow falls outside the window, words spill out of me. I tell her things I've never shared before, painful stories I thought I'd left behind in Poland. I talk all night. The next morning, Vitek and Cheyenne are the first to arrive. In the quiet of my hospital room, I share these stories with them too. I'm sure I am going to die, and I want them to know my history, which is their history as well. I especially want Vitek to know more about his father, Witold, a brilliant computer scientist. I also have a selfish reason for telling these stories. I need to express my fear about what is happening within my body, to give voice to the family history that is now repeating itself in the most painful way. Because when my son was only 7 years old, his father died of the very type of cancer I now appear to have. Melanoma that metastasized to the brain. Vitek was still a toddler, and his sister Kasia, a 5-year-old, when my husband told me the news. It was June 1980, a hot and sunny day in Warsaw, Poland. I was 29 years old, a young wife and mother, cutting up vegetables to make dinner. When Witold walked into our home, his face contorted with fear. The words that poured from him were so dreadful I could barely process them. Earlier in the day, he had gone to the local hospital to see a dermatologist after spotting a dark mole on his back. The doctor had taken one glance and announced that Witold had melanoma. "He said I'm going to die," Witold said. 8 months at best. I wanted to scream, but no sounds came out. Finally, I shouted, "He must be wrong." Surely the doctor was just another quack, one of the many awful medical professionals in the healthcare system in communist Poland. One look at Witold told you that he was perfectly healthy. He was handsome, broad-shouldered and muscular, a swimmer and runner at a time when almost no one else in Poland ran for exercise. We were a beautiful young family with two picture-perfect children. By Polish standards, we were well-to-do, accomplished and worldly. We had just spent the 1978 to 1979 academic year at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, where Witold had studied on a Fulbright scholarship. We had ambitious plans for our future. Cancer was not among them. Early the next morning, we rushed to the same Warsaw hospital, demanding to be seen. The doctor was solemn and cold as he repeated his original diagnosis. Witold would die within months. "There is no cure," he said. "Prepare yourselves." I felt faint. A nurse pressed a Valium into my palm and ushered us out of the door. "We're not going to tell anyone about this," Witold whispered as we lay in bed that night. In Poland at the time, cancer carried a stigma. Even among our enlightened and educated friends, it was viewed as a sign of weakness and loss of control over one's life. Talking about it was taboo. A few days later, an oncologist confirmed that Witold had melanoma and scheduled immediate surgery. Within weeks, the melanoma had been excised. My husband had begun chemotherapy. The infusion unit in the Institute of Oncology on Wawelska Street in Warsaw was frightening and depressing. To make matters worse, we, like most people at the time, knew almost nothing about chemotherapy. No one told us what to expect or what the treatment was intended to accomplish. Doctors and their staffs didn't communicate with patients, and families were left completely to their own devices. In those years before the internet, there was no easy way to get information. I was very aware, however, that our situation was grim. Cancer, especially melanoma, was considered a terminal disease. Very few lived through it. But the weeks passed and Witold did not die. After surgery and several rounds of chemo, he returned to his normal life, and quickly I started to forget that his cancer had ever appeared. I did more than forget. I deliberately kicked his illness out of my consciousness. I shoved it into a dark corner of my mind, covered it with layers of superficial happiness, and nailed it shut with vodka and partying. Still, the nightmare of his disease, no matter how deeply submerged in my unconscious, hung over us. Witold grew more and more withdrawn, and in our denial of the seriousness of his illness, we pushed each other away. I was scared, as much as I tried to believe I wasn't. Fear fueled our isolation, and we drifted farther apart. By the end of 1981, the political situation in Poland had come to mirror my deteriorating marriage. That December, the communist government declared martial law in an attempt to crush mounting political opposition inside the country, drastically limiting the freedom of Poles and sending the nation's already wobbly economy into a tailspin. The streets of Warsaw were blocked with tanks and patrolled by Polish soldiers in full military gear. On freezing nights, they warmed themselves at makeshift fires that bloomed across the dark city. It was an alien world to us, frightening, practically a war zone. Long lines of people waited for food in front of empty stores. Soldiers at checkpoints examined IDs. People rushed home before curfew for fear of being arrested. Friends were thrown into jail. By the time I fell in love with another man, Mirek, my marriage with Witold was all but over. I consoled myself with this fact each time I fell into Mirek's arms. His steady presence was exactly what my children and I needed. Witold took the news of my infidelity hard. He disappeared from our lives by moving to France, and he visited the children only a few times over the next 2 years. Crossing back and forth to the west wasn't easy. On one visit, as he was leaving my apartment, Witold turned in the doorway and told me I was a great mother, that I had always been such a strong force, standing unconditionally by our children, and that he envied my conviction and dedication to them. He was sad, warm and humble. He kissed me goodbye, his first friendly gesture in years. I had no way of knowing it then, but those would be Witold's last words to me. In May 1985, a few months after that visit to Warsaw, he died in a hospital in Bordeaux, France. The cancer had metastasized to his brain.